Always record. 187.
You thought I was in somewhere else?
I thought you were still in Europe. Here, my reception might be bad. I'll go back.
Yeah, you were breaking up there, Dennis.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry. Is it any better now?
Yeah, it's better.
Okay.
I mean, Georgia is considered on the edge of Europe. There's a debate about where exactly it lies, so...
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then, yeah, I thought you meant Georgia, USA a second ago, but I just woke up 5 minutes ago, so.
sorry to wake you up. I just wrote you a text there.
No, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did. I put the kids to bed, and I was so tired, I just fell asleep, and I'm here.
I'm here. All right. Well, let's just go to. Where's my Skype window? I've become a kind of a hater. I think. There we go. All right. Contacts. Alan is active now? Alan, are you on this call?
I didn't finish very many of these darn stories. I really liked them. But...
Which ones? I'm curious, because I kind of just honed in on three that were crossovers in both the collections.
Okay.
And I think they were the ones that Doug was emailing about too. Those are the Garden of Forking Paths. I saw you were posting some of that on Instagram.
I did that. Yeah. Yes.
The Babylon Lottery. Did you do that one?
I don't know if I did.
And then the Library of Babel, or the Library of Babel. Did you do that one?
I don't know. I went down I started in the audiobook, and I got several chapters in. I would say like four or five chapters in, but I only remember Garden.
I understand. Before. It's interesting because I think, Dennis, I understand why. I'm going to have to save this thought, okay?
Yeah, you do that.
There's something about his writing that's really interesting in that, yeah. I made a note here.
I know SJ has some really nice thoughts on this, so.
I'll try, yeah.
No, I know. But I could see, SJ, you had made the comment that you, felt like it could have been written today, and I really saw that in Forking Paths, and yeah.
Well, yeah. It's too. It's 2 minutes past. Do we chill out for a bit, or do we just?
Wait, what are you hoping to accomplish by the chill out portion?
Some other people show up, maybe.
Okay, because I'm not going to get any work done or any additional reading done in the next.
No.
Maybe we can wait, maybe like another three or four, just maybe 5 minutes, or maybe even say 10 after a round number, and just see if someone shows. I mean, I was hoping Znor, he seemed to have read everything.
Yeah, that would be cool.
And maybe we could just wait. Does that sound good? Is everybody cool with that? Is that?
Yeah, that's great. I think the only issue... So I was definitely... I scheduled this later than what we've been doing. And that is, you know, so you weren't having to get up at 4 in the morning. SJ. It's but you seemed really interested, and so I definitely wanted to. I just don't know. So I think that's about. I think the last one we started about 6 p.m., which ends up being morning-ish for Zenor.
Yeah, I think he's probably 4 hours ahead of me, so he's probably like noon would be my guess. Just because he's in Japan, let's see, time in Tokyo. Yeah, it's 1 p.m. right now in Tokyo. So that should be,
oh,
I mean...
I just got a... He's on.
Okay, sweet.
Oh, good. That's not cool. Oh, we're fucking saved now.
let me add him to the call. I don't understand how. I just don't understand. I'm sorry.
Doug, where's your wife going? Sounds like she's leaving.
No, I think she's just...
she's got to meet somebody out front. Or...
No. All right, everyone in this house, I'm doing a very important show.
She's on the phone. Don't bother her.
Go stand
with your important show. Yeah, what a jerk.
I know.
I agree with him.
I do these shows like every other day, too. Are you... Why? what if I... I'm not having any luck with Znor.
Oh.
I'm gonna. It says Nora unavailable. I'm gonna hang up this particular call, and then reignite it and see what happens. Wait.
Right.
What if I 3 of 8 in the call, Dennis Doug say not on this call. And what if I push this button? Calling Snore. Oh, there we go.
Hello.
Hi, Zenor.
How you doing?
Hey. Hey, good to hear.
I want to look. Who's
on the call? Kent.
We've got
Dennis and SJ and Douglas Bowles.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
SJ, where are you now?
I'm in Belize.
Where's that?
For Sheezy.
In Georgia. Sorry, it's the capital of the Republic of Georgia.
Tbilisi, wow.
Yeah, Tbilisi.
How do you say it?
I say it Belize like a silent T, but I could be getting it wrong.
Wait, probably I'm getting it wrong because you're the one there. <You know? laughs>
I know in Minsk that's how people refer to it, but that could be a Russian like variation. And here it's just, yeah, it's, you know, I'm not as familiar yet with, I haven't really been here that long, so I'm just kind of not really in tune yet. And Georgian is just a crazy language. Like people are, I mean, I can't understand any, like even one syllable.
It's so. The land of Gurdjieff, right?
Let's see here. I mean, I think this whole area is there's like a nexus here of many countries and many ethnicities. And so, like, just over the Caucasus Mountains, you have, like, a bunch of areas in Russia, like Dagestan, where that UFC fighter was from.
McGregor.
And there's just, like, 30 ethnicities in Dagestan. So I don't know. And even in Georgia, there's, like, Azerbaijan and Armenia are close. And I know there's some Armenians and Azerbaijanis here. So I think, let me check here. Gurdjieff. Just quickly check. I'm curious here. He's Armenian. Yeah.
Oh, he's Armenian. Okay. Yeah.
Armenian and Greek descent. Born in Armenia.
Okay. What?
Armenian.
Georgia. Yeah.
So, but it's interesting. Yeah, this part of the world. I mean, I've never been around here, and it's you can definitely feel like the Middle Eastern influence, and the language kind of sounds closer to Arabic than even Russian. So it's kind of a blend. So there's that blending that's happening. You can really feel that blending.
Yeah, I'd love to go. I'd love to go to that area.
Yeah.
Where have you been now? Like you're in Thailand, and then are you slowly making your way across?
I'm not really sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna be here. Part of why I came here is because it's really cheap. One, but yeah. Two, the visa policy is so good. I mean, they don't even ask for any kind of payment or anything. You just show up and you can stay here, I think, for a year. So,
wow.
That's kind of why I'm here. I don't know if I'll be here for that long, but I just kind of figured I'd come back here instead of Thailand, just because it's a little closer to Europe. And, you know, I was sort of, I don't know, the pollution in Thailand is pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot, it's actually a lot better than it was.
Oh,
they got rid of all those single stroke engine motorcycles or most of them. When I was living there, it was like there's black smoke everywhere, you know. but I think the air is actually better there now than it was.
Okay, I saw a story today like it was showing pictures of from Daily Mail that I guess the smog has descended on Bangkok, and there was like people with blood coming out of their nose.
It was like
a social media thing where people were posting pictures. And I have one of my friends that's posting. She lives in Bangkok. She was flying back from somewhere, and she was like back to the cancer air or something like that. So I think there's a unique cloud like just this week that hopefully will dissipate really soon for those folks. I felt it when I was there, even in December, just walking around Chiang Mai. I mean, it was hard. It was difficult for me.
Well, even in Chiang Mai, wow. So maybe it's changed again.
And they burn. They start burning around this time. And so it gets really, really bad because they burn trash everywhere.
Oh, jeez. It's delightful.
But anyhow, yeah, so I'm just here. No, it's nice. I didn't realize, I guess this is, I'm learning about this culture, but this is apparently one of the first cultures to convert to Christianity, one of the earliest. And so there's a big Christian influence here.
Yeah, that might be something to check in. I was thinking about that too, the original Georgian church, that's supposed to be interesting, how it's different than the Roman Orthodoxy that comes afterwards.
Uh-huh. All right, everyone's here. Everyone is here. Everyone is here. Should we do this?
Let's do it.
Officially? All right, here we go. Are you guys ready? My house is loud tonight. I'm very sorry. I'm going to do a little reading, as per is my usual.
Hey, Zanor, I want to apologize. I haven't finished as much of the book of it as I'd like to have, but I'm here. I've read a couple of the stories, but
yeah, I think that's fine. Like, I was wondering how we're gonna do this, even because
yeah, me too. But we're gonna do it.
Could be all the stories. It could be one or two of the stories. Could be fine.
All right. I don't know. That's, yeah.
Yeah, so this is from the Garden of Forking Paths. that a fabric of times that approach one another fork are snipped off or are simply unknown for centuries contains all possibilities. In most of those times, we do not exist. In some, you exist, but I do not. In others, I do and you do not. In others still, we both do. In this one, which the favoring hand of chance has dealt me, you have come to my house. In another, when you have come through my garden, you find me dead. In another, I say these same words, but I am an error, a ghost.
Sounds like a double slit experiment, practically.
Let me read as a response to that, the final paragraph or the final two several sentences of the Library of Babel. He says, I dare insinuate the following solution to this ancient problem. The library is limitless and periodic. If an eternal voyager were to traverse it in any direction, he would find after many centuries that the same volumes are repeated in the same disorder, which repeated would constitute an order, order itself. My solitude rejoices in this elegant hope.
Yeah, I love that. I love that last little phrase, that even that is enough. Even that is enough of a pattern to make him hopeful. that there are infinite universes of meaninglessness that repeat, but the very fact that they repeat makes it hopeful.
The idea of these Platonic kind of Platonic ideas that sort of then manifest and repeat through time. I think you're seeing some of that. I mean, this is one other potential solution, that there's kind of an archetypical realm that then just kind of recasts itself. And so you have things like Julius Caesar being assassinated and then John F. Kennedy being assassinated. I mean, there's these echoes.
Oh, that's a good one too. Do you remember the name of that story?
I don't think that wasn't a story. I was just kind of throwing out some ideas.
Well, no, he writes about that too, though. That is one of his stories.
Okay, no, I missed that one.
Yeah, let me try to look that one up, because that's an interesting one too.
Well, as a digression into that, so it's interesting because, like, infinity is one of the topics, and so recently I was reading this article about the. Do you guys know of the Indian peasant mathematician who did all this really interesting work on the subject of infinity? That I can't say his name. I don't know. It's like
Rajamanaman.
Yeah. But it's interesting because people that do, I think Cantor was one of the guys who did some, like, I think it made him crazy. Like, when you get into that subject, and David Foster Wallace did too. Like, he did a brief introduction to infinity. Like, there's something that's really unraveling about, like, touching that. But that I love that there is this idea of it's both infinite but then finite. You know, like the. It doesn't make sense, but, like, it's almost like, you know, how the earth is round, where you go through the Library of Babel and eventually, you know, you end up where you started, even though that's not what that said.
And, you know, that really underscores something, Doug, for me, is that these stories are so small. I mean, it's like there's such a limited form, this really restricted kind of truncated form that is the container for these idea of this exploration of infinity. So there's really a kind of an irony there.
But they all have such, like, they all have particularities. Like it's funny, every time I read the Aleph, I forget, like, you know, there's all this kind of petty, you know, so it starts out and it's about this poet who's going to write a poem that's going to encapsulate the entire world, right? And, you know, Borges is like, and you think he's a narrator. He's just really annoyed with the guy, and he thinks he's kind of a schmuck. And, you know, it goes
his
on.
Poem sucks.
Yeah. But then he's like, oh, by the way, I have a point in my cellar, in my basement, that reflects all the points in all the universe, and you can see everything. It's like, what? Oh, I'll check that out. And so it just
and then when he finally gets down into the cellar, and he has to lie on his back in the cellar and look up at one of the stairs, and of course the guy closes the cellar door on top of him from the top, and so he's in darkness, and then he's terrified at one moment that he's just let himself be trapped by a madman in the cellar, and he's never going to be discovered again. That's a great point. And so, and then he sees the olive.
Right. But what I remember is like, you know, this is ineffable. And then he goes on and describes it, like what it contained. And it's like, wow, you know, like he was able to somehow articulate the ineffable. Like what is everything? And so like there's these lofty aims of this bad poet, but at the same time, Borges is kind of doing that. Like he's putting the whole universe in the stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the infinity of integers between one and two. Right?
Mm-hmm. Wait, is that in the story? Because that would be just a nonsensical statement. Is just mathematically the infinity of integers, because one, the integer following one is two, so there would be no integers in between. Yeah, that's right. I'd like to have to get into that one. That sounds crazy.
Did you find your the JFK story you were talking about?
Well, there is one on JFK, right? But that's not the one. Like the there's one called In Memoriam JFK. But there's one on Lincoln too, on Caesar and Lincoln.
So here's a question for you, Znor. Over the course of his career, because the book is structured, you know, it's his earliest works, and then it moves to his later works. Like, I heard criticism that his later works were not as good as his earlier works.
Well, yeah, that's interesting, because so his first, like, you go through the whole thing. The first thing that he put out, the first book, a collection of short stories, is The Universal History of Iniquity, which is 1935. And they're great stories, right? And I think you asked us to do one of those, The Man on Pink Corner, but these are all great stories, but then they're pretty conventional. And then the next thing that comes out is the Ficciones in 1944, after he has his head injury, and that's when he gets into the real psychedelic stuff that we've been talking about. And then he's got the Aleph, which is 1949, and then yeah, he gets less and less as he So in his later stuff, I think in that quote that you read at the beginning, Doug, he's talking about the old Borges was writing about things like labyrinths and so on. And I think at the end, he just wants to, I think he sort of internalizes this idea that the infinite could be in anything. And so why not just write about normal conventional stories of interesting people, right? But it's all there, you know. You don't need this kind of magical realism or the things that he became famous for. You know, he sort of rejected that and said, "Well, I can just write conventional stories about interesting characters, people who've had interesting lives, and that will contain these infinities." So so it is sort of like that. You read his later stories, they're not as psychedelic and interesting in the way that Ficciones is, but they're still great stories. But it almost does seem like it's another Borges, like there's more than one author.
Well, towards the end of his life, he definitely was completely blind, I think, and he was so like he wasn't able to read anymore, and he had to like dictate his stories maybe to his mother or to his secretary. You were going to say something, Lacey?
I read one of his... Oh. Yeah, can you... I have poor connection. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very well. Okay, great. I read one of his later stories before I read the first group. And it kind of threw me off a little bit because the later one was almost smoother in the narration. And so it kind of just flowed better in my brain. And I was able to really get sucked into it and feel a part of the story. And then I really had to work harder to find the flow. So it kind of threw me off.
So you thought he was a better writer later on?
Not a better writer, but just I was gripped by it more quickly. It was really, he paints such a beautiful picture that you can kind of just fall into it and feel like you're, at least the story I read, I felt like I was just in it and living it, watching the characters. And then I went back and read, I think I read one of the first ones that I read after that was the one where it's the book that he's reviewing and kind of like pointing all the good parts about it and just kind of like listing everything. And I just couldn't find that. It was such a contrast that I just couldn't find the flow with it. Kind of threw me off.
Do you remember the first one you were mentioning?
Yeah, I wrote it down. I made a note. It was one about the brothers and they love this woman and the only way that they cannot love her is to kill her.
Yeah, what one is that one?
But there's like a knife fight and they're at a dance and the knife flies out and the woman chooses the other guy. I just can't remember how it all went, but
I think his mother gave him that ending.
Like that. Oh, really?
Kill the girl.
I want to say it's the interloper. Is that it?
Yeah.
I'm looking.
Yeah, I wish
I remember that one too, but I don't.
Yeah, the interloper.
That's with the two brothers, and with the woman, and she. At one point, they try to, they're becoming rivals for her love, and so, but they also love each other, and so, to try to solve their problem, they send her away to a brothel or something, right?
Yeah, and actually, I'm mixing two stories in my memory, but yeah, that was the first one I read. They sent her away to a brothel. But and then they brought her back.
And then they brought her back, yeah. <You know.
laughs> But it was, and I'm looking at it now, it's only like 4 pages. And I think that it was this short story that just felt like it had so much depth to it.
Yeah.
Is why he is such a great writer, because he can build this depth that you feel that the story does continue after you're done reading it. You're still thinking about it, or you just like see the brothers ride off into the sunset together, happy, and there's a mound of dirt behind them.
Yeah, so that one is from 1970, so definitely one of his later ones. But yeah, it's like that. The same ideas of the infinite are there, but it just in a really simple narrative. That's Yeah, I like that one too.
Yeah, he can really drag out, like makes you really feel that it's infinite. And then the other one where it's like a party and there's a knife fight, and the knife like flies out the window, and then they kill the guy. And did you guys read that one?
That one might be Man on Pink Corner, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
So then that one's one of the first ones.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's okay. Wild. But then there's a what is the one? The story from Rosendo Juarez.
I think that somehow, and that's from later, but they connect somehow.
Yeah, that's the perspective of another guy in that story. It's the perspective of the guy who walks away from the knife fight, and everybody thinks he's a coward. I think.
Oh. Is it?
Let me see it again. Yeah, it's so easy to get all these stories mixed up.
Yeah, that's a story, I think, in Ficcione's part two, where there's a guy that's waiting, and then the guy comes back and says, all right, are you ready? And then they have a knife fight. And it's like the, I think it's either the prequel or the sequel to another knife fight story that I didn't, that wasn't included in, this volume. Let me try to find that one.
Yeah, so this one, the story of Rosendo Juarez is kind of the sequel or the other part to A Night on Pink Corner.
I'm thinking about another one at the end, the story called The End, and it's a kind of a knife fight. It's a great folk poem, and it takes the story up where the folk poem leaves off.
Mm.
So that's another knife fight kind of story. I guess he's got a thing for knives.
Yeah, that's what he was known for, is his fights on duels. I mean, his writing on the knife duels.
Yeah, there's something kind of gritty about, like, he's really able to take you into that quarter of Argentina.
But then he makes fun of himself in one story, one of the later stories too, where he meets this other writer, and the other writer's making fun of Borges for just writing about these things and not really having experience of them, whereas this guy did have experience of living on the rough side.
What, and that actually, so there's some people that are really, so like I think of Ayn Rand, and I really haven't read her, but she really wasn't someone you'd want to take life advice from, but she definitely commanded this giant audience. Like, yeah. I don't know that she was a good, I wonder if Borges was a little bit like that too, in that, like, he didn't do a ton of living per se, but I don't know. What do I know?
He's not like who's a good example of that? Maybe a writer that almost, like, I guess Rambo ran guns after he wrote. I'm trying to, you know, there's others that were, you know, known for maybe Burroughs killed his wife, these kind of things.
Well, so like, what, this is the guy who, Hemingway definitely, I mean, it seemed like he was doing all those things that he was writing about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hard to tell. Like, it's hard to, the myth of a writer and the myth of a writer's life and then what they write about, you know?
Right.
So Hemingway painted himself as a man of action as well. Right? Went out big game hunting and fought in the Spanish Civil War and the fishing and all fights, all kinds of stuff, right? But who knows how much.
Yeah.
Sorry to jump in there. I was just thinking Orwell fought the Spanish Civil War, and his books, what did he write about Down and Out Paris and London? Apparently he went and lived in the, you know, fact with the people, as it were. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there is this as well.
Yeah, the idea that writers often will write their biographies too, like Bukowski, you know, towards the end was writing these novels about his youth, and, you know, a good writer can make his biography really very compelling, in a way that's just reliant on the writing, the quality of the writing, and kind of the ability to mythologize like one event or something like this and make it greater than maybe it seemed in the moment.
Which kind of, so like something I've been thinking about is the idea of memory. And that, so oftentimes we think of memory, or in stories especially, where it's almost like this camera that just captures everything that's happening. But memory is this alive, living thing that changes the more times you remember things. And so you can actually kind of change the details of what was happening because you're putting different things together. So like, do you remember? So I was listening to this podcast is why this came up. But when Brian Williams put himself in the chopper that took fire, but when in fact he sure. really, he wasn't in the chopper, but he was just so flummoxed when he was trying to explain why, you know, he wasn't trying to take credit. It's just in his he remembered, like the story just morphed in his mind, and all of a sudden the memory changed, and all of a sudden he was in the chopper.
Get to the chopper.
Everyone, run to the chopper.
Or Al Gore in the internet. But that's not the same. But
well, history is a living thing, you know, and
yeah.
The winner writes history. And I mean, that's another Orwell quote that I really like. I know he's kind of used a lot these days, but you know, he who controls the present controls the past. Is this mm-hmm. the quote where you basically, you know, if you can, when they change history in 1984, and I know this isn't quite what you're getting at, Doug, but I think it relates to this idea of, you know, well, idea, thought, language, that which is propagated can kind mm-hmm. of form delimit our potential. You know, it's like a Foucauldian concept too of knowledge/power. And I think it's, yeah, I mean, we do it in our lives as well in terms of how we talk about ourselves, self-talk, as it were.
Well, and so, like, that's where I got, you know, so perhaps in Hemingway's mind, you know, that's what he was doing. He had all that bravado, but, you know, it might not have been.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the other aspect, like what you were saying, SJ, is that our moment is so strange because it does seem like truth has become less solid and it's a lot more fragile and things. So, you know, we don't even know where to stand as, you know, as far as it feels like, because we're living two lives and things are so easily refuted on, you know, on the internet. You know, it's a post-truth moment. You know, we have lives of fake book. You know what? Yeah.
And this reminds me of that story. Funes, his memory. That one. Do you remember that?
Yeah, very well. Yeah.
So there's that quote here. It's like, I myself alone have more memories than all mankind since the world began, he said to me. And also, my dreams are like other people's waking hours. And again, toward dawn, my memory, sir, is like a garbage heap. A circle drawn on a blackboard, a right triangle, a rhombus, all these are forms that we can fully intuit. Arrhenio could do the same with the stormy mane of a young colt, a small herd of cattle on a mountainside, a flickering fire and its uncountable ashes, and the many faces of a dead man at a wake. I have no idea how many stars he saw in the sky. Perfect memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh.
And this guy's interesting too, because he gets his perfect memory from an accident that he had, which makes me go back again to Borges' accident and what happened to him afterwards.
But then that towards the, you know, the end of his career, he's writing the story Shakespeare's Memory, where you
he's trying to get rid of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Someone, you have to, you know, do you want Shakespeare's memory? And you say yes. And then you can't really, like, you just have to let it come to you. And so that was this idea that, you know, like you're actually two people, you know.
Do you remember what is the curse of What is the curse of that afterwards? Like he, I'm trying to remember that story exactly.
But there's something about versus this other person it's almost like a parasite or like a meme that's reprogrammed, you know, reprogrammed you.
It seems like it's even worse than that. I can't remember what it is.
In Funes, he dies, right? He shrivels up into like a little ball and he dies. Isn't that true? I mean, the memories are so oppressive that it sucks his life force from him.
Yeah, he becomes ancient so quickly. I can't turn that.
And that story, the Paris Review published maybe 4 or 5 years ago, out of all, I'm reading Borges now, really? At least the collection, that's the story that was picked to be published. Hmm. The Funes, the Memorius, or Funes.
Yeah, I was reading that. There's even a kind of a controversy of how to translate that from Spanish to English, like even the title. In Spanish, it's like you just said it, SJ. What was it? The
Memorius? Memorius. The Memorius, I think, something like this.
To translate that directly into English is difficult to do. So the translator of this book, the collected fictions, he just decides on Funes, his memory, instead of Funes and giving him this title of this, like, basically, it's like a memory master or something.
It's this other concept. I mean, Roland Barthes and I think some of these other postmodern thinkers have dissected or deconstructed the idea of an author. You know, who is the author? What is the author? And I think you see this theme here in Borges, you know, 20, 30, 40 years before. And I'm wondering if Barthes read some of these stories, you know, because he really does get at that. There's a story I really liked of Borges in the collection I read about Quixote. And the basic premise is that there's a writer who says, I'm going to write Don Quixote, like 200 years after, 300 years after. And that became his life's work, was writing Don Quixote. And it's all about my version of Quixote's different, and
Pierre Menard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that one blew my mind. You know,
it's and then at the end, it's the exact same text, right?
Yeah, but there's like a line in there where it's like, you know, the writing Don Quixote in you know 1900 is an achievement. It's different than writing it in like 1700 or whenever it was. Whenever it was written, let me see if I can. I mean, it, so you know, because it's just a whole different feat of imagination because of the place and time. You know?
And it's true. Like it's a true point, right? Like if you read Don Quixote now, you're reading it through all of this other, like all hundreds of years of history that have passed and everything that you've read and everything that all literature, all art that's gone into the culture that's part of what you've read, and that's all going into your reading. So it's not, it isn't the same book.
Here's a quote. He did not want to compose another Don Quixote, which would be easy, but the Don Quixote.
Yes. But that, just back to Shakespeare's memory, which is sort of connected, it says, so this is the part, he said, throughout the first stage of this adventure, I felt the joy of being Shakespeare. Throughout the last terror and oppression, at first the waters of the two memories did not mix. In time, the great torrent of Shakespeare threatened to flood my own modest stream, and very nearly did so. I noted with some nervousness that I was gradually forgetting the language of my parents. Since personal identity is based on memory, I feared for my sanity. That's kind of Lovecraftian as well.
Yeah, I think this book is a threat to the sanity of you know, the collective. That's why I think it's still before its time, because it's dangerous. This is a really dangerous book. I find, just to like political regimes and another Foucauldian concept, regimes of truth, you know.
Right. Yeah. This book,
it turns it all on its head, and it gives us a tool set, you know.
That's right. It breaks down all categories, right? Or allows you to do that yourself too. Like even categories that he hasn't broken down, he puts that kernel of doubt in your mind that when you come across any other categories that he hasn't broken down yet, you're able to start to do that. Yeah. Apparently Derrida was a huge fan of Borges, so I'm sure Barthes was as well.
Makes sense. I mean, this should be a band. That's maybe part of the genius of the book, is that I don't know if it's ever been banned, but this would be like, I feel like it should be on the list of banned books.
It probably will be in the future, you know, when it gets to this level, you know, when questioning your reality becomes. If that ever happens, like the other alternative is that it just forks off continually, right? Like that to me, it seems like maybe that's happening more than the other. Is that all these different possibilities are just more and more and more and more, and that nobody has control over anything. So maybe Borges is one of the people who helped to do that. It definitely shows the power of language, that language is able to do that kind of thing, and that it's not, even though we find language everywhere now and it's so disposable and interchangeable, there's still certain writers that can that can make things subversive still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a line in the Library of Babel where it says, it's like certain, these are like younger kids, I guess, would just worship these unintelligible texts that they can't even understand. And I feel like there is a spiritual quality to these stories where, you know, they maybe deserve this kind of adulation in a way, because of the place that they take us. You know, it's like we start this conversation and I had to go back and, just before this call, I was studying and I've got my quotes back out to really remind myself, because like you guys, it all becomes this blur of like infinity and labyrinth, you know.
I meant to do that too. I fell asleep doing my notes.
It should be worshipped. I mean, it's like it's this unintelligible kind of collection that I'm definitely, count me in. I'll show up to a ceremony for like a 30-minute.
But so it's funny, because I think you could easily spend like an hour talking about just one story if you wanted to like plumb the depths. But then there is this interesting, like there are themes in all the stories that come up again and again.
There are certain tie-ins too. Like he'll add a footnote sometimes. I can't give you an example, but where there'll be a footnote, and the footnote is a book written by a character in another story, right? And then if you start to really think of that, it's like, whoa, and then it sets up a whole new level of interconnection between these things. And I thought that was, he does that sparingly. I thought he would do that more, where everything becomes connected into one thing. It is thematically, but I thought he would even weave these characters together more. But he does do that in a few cases.
He writes about that too. There's a story where, you know, there's a repeating theme of people trying to piece together different bodies of literature, different written pieces to find connections.
Mm.
And so that he's doing that in his own work. It's also, I feel like Kubrickian, just to go back to Kubrick, I mean, where there's these kind of Easter eggs and repeated, like some people say, what the Lolita eight became an adult and was Alice, Bill's wife. You know, there's you know, there's these.
Yeah.
Maybe not as explicit there, but the house in Lolita is the same house as the house in Eyes Wide Shut, or the same group of people like we had talked about before. It's interesting.
Yeah, we haven't one of the ones we haven't talked about is the three versions of Judas, which I thought was a great one. It's actually my last Skype conversation I had just privately with Mark LeClaire. Mark brought up that story.
Oh, really? Mark lived with his mother.
Yeah.
I don't know that I read that one.
That's in Artifices, so it's the same. It's in that same Ficcione's collection, but it's in the second half, the Artifices.
What did Mark? Do you remember what Mark said about it?
I can't. That was like a few years ago. Like you just it might come back. We talked about it, but I think he was just talking about the story itself. You know, the idea of the story itself, which is that. Who's read that one?
I don't think I have.
SJ has. Okay, yeah. Where eventually it's how to summarize it? Like the last version of Judas is that. So Christ, God is Christ. God is Christ. God, to fully sacrifice himself, had to become fully a man to do so, right? And the only way that humanity could match that gift to God is that if someone were to fully take on all the sins of humanity, become the worst sinner, and then sacrifice himself to eternal damnation, which is what Judas did. So remember, he betrayed Christ, and then he killed himself. And because suicide is basically unforgivable, you just go to hell for killing yourself. And so, like in Dante's Inferno, Judas is right at the center of hell, like right in the hottest parts of hell, right next to Satan, because of his betrayal of Christ. But he makes it the story. So the story is about this kind of Gnostic sect who believe that Judas is actually the Messiah and not Christ, because his sacrifice is greater.
And I think it's about a guy that's writing this text and gets persecuted for it. So it's again this an idea of it's a story about a person writing this theory.
Yeah exactly. Mm-hmm.
And
this was referenced in the bio that I, but was that a way that you could approach these ideas without the ideas seemingly coming from Borges?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, this key idea in a story, that's what happens, is the guy basically gets ostracized from the community because his idea is just what Znor said, that God is Judas, this evil, the great evil is actually the incarnation of God. And so it's this kind of, I don't know, Luciferian, you know, to use that, you know, this idea that kind of evil is good sort of thing in a convoluted way. It goes, to me, it's this, like we've been talking about, it's the idea that you can linguistically and rationally construct a truth that completely contradicts and upends the conventional model. But it's rational. When you read it, he makes a strong case.
If you take the logic to its extreme, then you can prove the opposite point, which is what Bruno was talking about. Giordano Bruno was talking about in the Renaissance. But
wasn't he arrested and maybe
burnt to the stake? And
burnt to the stake. So
yeah. Yeah, I don't know of Borges. religion. I was talking to a friend and he said that Borges was a Christian, but I can't see him being an Orthodox Christian. Do you guys know anything about that? From what I thought, he was kind of his own type of Gnostic, like maybe a Christian Gnostic, but not in any sense an Orthodox Christian, but I wasn't able to find out much about that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was wondering if he might have been a converso. You know, that just because of a lot of the stories had a lot of Hebrew, like Hebraic knowledge, but that's like we've talked. I mean, it wouldn't have to be that, but I'm just, I have no idea here. Let's see here. Rummaging through his Wikipedia biography.
For some reason, I wasn't him as a Catholic, but I think there was. He might have had mixed heritage, like maybe.
Yeah, he did.
And that's how they. It seems like they, because of various political struggles, like they ended up in maybe Switzerland for a while. And there was also a funny thing that happened where he was removed from his post at the library and the dictatorial leader put him as an inspector of chickens and bunnies or something. He was the new chicken and bunny inspector, but he declined the post.
Yeah, so his father was from English descent and spoke English in the home. Borges is his father, and they traveled all over Europe. It says here at age 9, Borges translated Oscar Wilde's The Happy Prince into Spanish. So he was already that proficient with English at 9 that he could produce a translation. And the mother was from the Spanish, just colonizers of South America. It's all it says here, but there's nothing traditional Uruguayan family of Cirilo origin. So I'm not saying anything about religion here, but yeah, that's clearly a European, I mean, heavily European and English.
You could just where do you
go from here?
Maybe something just so stripped down, totally character based, kind of like, you know, Lucy was talked about earlier. Just something that's no magic realism, I guess. Hard realism. Is there like 21st century hard realism? I feel like I've read some.
Oh yeah, that's like the whole.
That was Borges' point on Ulysses. If you go too far into realism, you get into madness.
This is Walls thinking about our body, what they mean for our salvation. Keep spinning.